They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Can you imagine that strange guy everyone in town knows is a creep but collectively decides to ignore? If you're a small-town listener, you could probably think of someone that fits that description pretty well. As we are told in the book The Passerby by Thomas Ray Crowell, it is the eponymous passerby that is the neighborhood spook. He is an enigma who comes and goes, leaving in his wake a trail of suspicious rumors and strange anecdotes. In this episode, we hope to share the town gossip surrounding both the passerby, Mike Emanaker, and Brandy's mother, Roxy. I'm your host, Gracie, and welcome back to another episode of Underestimated Brandy Peltz. Now, this episode has the same warning as the previous, that being that this book is shrouded in uncertainty and is thus treated as a resource rather than an answer. There is some debate about whether or not this information is accurate, so we're moving forward with some skepticism in mind. As we covered in our first episode, the crime was discovered by a passerby on the street just before 3. He claimed to be passing by when he saw the house on fire and called a neighbor. However, we found some details in his story to be suspicious. During the author's investigation, he looked into the passerby and was able to speak to people directly, as well as look further into those inconsistencies. What he found were rumors on top of rumors. But to truly understand the book's rendition of the passerby, we have to start long before the fire. Before a little girl's murder shocked the town. Even before the Peltz's personal tragedy, nobody felt comfortable with the passerby, better known outside of the pages as Michael Emanaker. Mike Emanaker was an agricultural teacher. The librarian at the school where he used to work remembered him, not as a teacher, but as a creep. Sometimes he would come into her office and just stand there. Not in need of a book or files, but just staring out at the children. She said it felt wrong to her, different from a teacher doing his job. She wasn't the only one who disliked him. Plenty of people around the town scorned or distrusted Mike. The town coordinator, Pauline, said that she wouldn't be surprised if he had killed Brandy, because he had a strange look in his eye. The pattern seemed to be that Mike always wanted to talk. He had a lot of time on his hands and wanted to come waste your time in turn. He had the vibe of a con man, like he would, quote, sell you a faulty product and have no qualms about it. For these reasons, other teachers often tried to avoid talking to him in the halls, and they tried to convince him to bother someone else when they did get stuck with him. Unfortunately, it wasn't just talk. Suspicious things were swept under the rug, things that went unnoticed at the time but became unforgettable after all that happened in Argus. While investigating a connection at the school, the author encountered a custodian. This staff member alleges that he saw the passerby coming out of the girls' bathroom. No emergency, no alarm. He just kept walking like it was nothing. More than suspicious, it was outright wrong. Unfortunately, this isn't our last story of Mike spreading unease. His presence was felt across the entire town. One neighbor says that she saw Mike's car driving by at a crawl. What may otherwise be a forgettable moment chilled her to the bone, so much so that she rushed inside to call her sister. Maybe he was calmly measuring her, the house, and its distance, or maybe he was just lost in thought, admiring her flowers. We will never know what he was thinking, but the fact that he was so immediately unnerving is worth noting. Another neighbor attests that one night, amid an alcohol-fueled conversation, Mike just stared at her, eerily silent. His friend did the talking, engaging in all of the usual small talk while he remained still. He wasn't just socially awkward, she notes, not just shy. He was weird, in a way that made you run inside to lock your door. Being strange may be enough for the court of public opinion, but in the court of law, there were no cases against Mike Emanaker. The author thought his search was going to be fruitless yet again, up until he met with a friend of the passerby named Gordon. He told of a conversation they had a long time ago, in which Gordon shared his thoughts on the ongoing murder investigation in a nearby town. Maybe the cases were connected, he said. thinking of the three unsolved murders, victims that would remain that way to this day. The passerby replies, quite strangely, by bragging that he's a suspect in Brandy's case, as if it were something to be proud of. This is consistent with another aspect of the author's pet theory, that none of the local newspapers released the passerby's name because the authorities had a hold on the flow of information. It was Mike himself who went to a nearby town to tell his story, one in which his name was found alongside words of heroism. Except, in following the current pattern, his reactions get more and more unnerving. Gordon, jokingly, of course, asks Mike if he was the one who hurt Brandy. Humor is how some people grapple with mortality, after all. Only his companion didn't laugh, didn't deny it, didn't reply at all. After giving his characteristic eerie stare, he stood up and walked away. Gordon notes that it was strange for Mike to be so bothered by these things, and he was genuinely surprised that his joke had caused such offense. Our next depraved story comes from the country-based side of Argus, a retired farmer with roots in the community. Apparently, Mike liked to visit his home on occasion, but he would always show up without warning and without any due respect. On this particular day, it had been 6 years since the farmer had last heard from him. He dropped in to inquire about his granddaughter, a junior at the school where he taught. He seemed to know a lot about her, more so than an acquaintance should. The farmer's grandson went to the same school too, yet he didn't say a word about him. It was just the girl, always the girl. Once again, his creepy disposition forced its way into the picture. The farmer ends the interview by saying that he'd shoot him if he tried anything. However, the gun would later be pointed in the opposite direction. A neighbor and the farmer's grandson had wandered onto Mike's property during a hunting incident, and rather than calmly asking his neighbors to leave, he pointed his gun at them and issued a direct threat. Maybe it's just small-town rules, but it was bad enough that the farmer called the teacher's aide and asked that he keep an eye on his granddaughter. No one was taking chances around Mike Emenacre. The passerby had a bizarre way of talking about girls and death. An officer reached out to share a story. He told the story of how a schoolteacher and a teenage girl went to have a picnic in the woods after dark. When he came upon their car, the two emerged from the woods, looking very disheveled. Most people would think that it's wrong. They'd be outraged. But we know Mike better than that at this point. He replied that it wasn't a big deal and that what she was doing was her business. He was a man with a total lack of moral compass. At such a horrible thing, he just shrugged. It was always a shrug. At this point, Gordon reappears in the book. When his son-in-law died, he was a wreck. He said he invited his drinking buddy Mike to the funeral, during which he said, "Don't worry, your daughter's young. You'll get a new one." Like a beloved member of his family could somehow be replaced. He was always like that, unfeeling about death and flippant about boundaries. Across the book, several people make attempts to explain his behavior, not as justification, but as an answer to the author's incessant questions. For a lot of the townspeople, their answer was Vietnam. Mike was a war veteran, and people like to say that he came back from Vietnam different. Others like to say that his problem started long before, that he's always been a source of scrutiny. Perhaps combat worsened his existing issues, exposing a sadist under the surface. He was heard at one of the markets in town bragging about all of the people he had killed during the war. Once again, his reaction is wrong. Not regretful or somber, but proud. Bragging. When a local veteran died, Mike attended the funeral. When asked what happened, he just shrugged again, saying that it was like the rest of the veterans. Just bad stuff from the war, and he made pretty much the same comment about a veteran who had committed suicide the year before. There was no real emotion. It was just another story to him. It was the author who tried to chase down another explanation. He had become convinced that something had happened to him as a child, specifically abuse at the church. But the records of old priests in the parish that might have answered those questions were gone, and the author's theory went up in smoke. What remained was the same local consensus. Whatever was wrong with Mike, it didn't start in Vietnam.
Thank you.
these are spurious rumors and claims without proof. To that end, not everyone saw Mike as a monster. Some remembered him differently. Miss Ledbetter knew him through the school. She saw him helping students, doing his job, just generally being a good teacher. She thought he was a hero, too, so valiant for wanting to save that poor little girl. But even she thought it was strange that he didn't stay to meet the firefighters. She believed that he had left teaching a year or so when the crime took place. She goes on to mention he was in a farm-related occupation now, and that in the past he had overseen a work-study program that gave him a lot of freedom. It sounded stable, responsible. But when others checked the records, there were some inconsistencies in the timeline. A superintendent pulled Mike's letter of resignation dated August 1985, a year and 4 months before Brandy's murder. High school yearbooks showed him present in 1986, but not in 1987. He was just there 1 year and gone the next. Another community member remembered him leaving the school system in December 1985, and he remembered the date clearly because the new agriculture teacher made a world of difference. Finally, someone who would actually teach, he said. According to that account, Mike left the school because he wanted more money and freedom. For about a year before Brandy's death, he worked at a feed and seed company and bragged about his riches and freedom. The other teachers thought he was obnoxious, so they weren't surprised when the job didn't last. He ended up back in a classroom this time at a different high school we'll call Bloom. The kids he taught didn't particularly like him. They called him lazy and worthless. Apparently, even the kids thought he was a player because he would come to school with scratches and bruises on his face. Word around the rumor mill was that an angry husband beat him up after school. That being said, the timeline of his jobs never really lines up. He's a drifter, never properly rooted, which leads to even more contradictions. Regardless of when he started there, he left some anecdotes behind at the farming co-op as well. His old co-workers had heard of his supposed heroism from the horse's mouth. Only, he looked nervous and twitchy as he was retelling his versions of events. He had a habit of exaggerating, so people struggled to believe him outright. These are three different sides of himself that Mike presented, the facsimiles of a teacher, a hero, and a simple passerby, with different sources all verifying a different sort of identity that he put forth. All that we have to rely on are consistent stories of his unnerving behaviors. Official reports of the fire at Brandy's house have unfortunately been lost to time. Argus was handled by another district's fire department at the time, and now that they've formed a new fire association with the surrounding small towns, the old files are impossible to locate, if they still exist. In light of this, we cannot say for certain what was used to start the fire. However, even without that, we can point out another curious fact about our conveniently placed passerby. As an agriculture teacher, he would know how to mix gasoline, diesel, and other things in order to start a fire of a certain type. He would know how to work the wood-burning furnace, and he would have access to anything he needed at the school. It may not be definitive proof, but a suspicious individual knowledgeable about fire and intrinsically intertwined with the case does not go unnoticed. With so many stories of Mike's unacceptable conduct, it's hard to imagine why people would be so tolerable of him.
In the small town of Argus, Indiana, suspicion spreads like wildfire, and it didn't stop with Mike. Eventually, it spread to Brandy's mother, Roxy, too. The general consensus was that the parents were very protective of their daughter, but the faint whispers of Roxy's behavior remained. According to rumors, her mother was a drinker and her father was a violent womanizer. Not a very healthy household to grow up in. Some claimed that Roxy herself dealt the killing blow, in a combination of anxious panic and depression. Another neighbor thought both of the parents were weird because they made their adopted children write letters to Brandy and then dropped them off at the cemetery. The more people talked about Roxy, the more claims shifted away from evidence and into an outright character assassination. Even her very own sister-in-law told the newspaper that it didn't embarrass her that she had been neglectful. She went so far as to outright say that she thought she was, quote, too jealous to be pretty. It also seems that the things Roxy did upset her even before they became family. She said that Roxy had always been very flirtatious in school, and that she was convinced she had been unfaithful. Perhaps she was right, according to the words of the author. Rumors spread everywhere that she had an affair with the Reverend, the sheriff's nephew, and even the passerby himself. These rumors were cultivated due to both Roxy's promiscuity and the increased attention that she gave them. While we're discussing the sheriff's department, we would like to revisit the house across to Brandy's home. As you mentioned in the first episode, there was an abandoned building across the way. It was the perfect place to sit and watch while you planned your crime. And in this case, there was evidence of that. Curtains pulled aside, a chair at the window, and an open door. All of that information is also found within the book's pages, but the author adds onto it by writing that the owner of the dilapidated home went into the authorities with this information. He thought they would go and check it out, get fingerprints, something, but no one ever got back to him. This, coupled with the accusations he made against the police department that we covered in our second episode, makes it seem like the author has something against the local police. Why did the author react in such a way? Was there truly something sinister going on among the authorities at the time? In situations like these, the book often leaves us with more questions than answers. Then there's what happened just hours before the fire. A phone call, a knock at the door, and lunch. According to our coworker Alan, Roxy liked to think that she was a good mother, even though Brandy struggled in some areas. Furthermore, Alan brought up the fact that Mike was a regular at the store, and that she knew him better than anyone else because she was the main clerk. Alan also supported the claims that Roxy returned home during her lunch break to check on Brandy, though he didn't mention who it was that drove her. He said that Roxy didn't seem panicked, so it must have been before the murder, and that she mentioned wanting to have lunch with her daughter. This is where the one document the author obtained comes into play, the coroner's report. Unfortunately, neither the author nor the coroner were interested in sharing the original document or the details contained within, so we have only the details he included in the book to go off of. Brandy and Ian just before she died, and the contents of her stomach were onions, mushrooms, tomato sauce, and dough. All of the ingredients of a pizza, what Roxy would have given her for lunch. This both proves that she wasn't there to harm her daughter, as the rumor suggested, and gives more evidence to support Butch's innocence. But is that the way it really played out? After Roxy left, Brandy would have been all alone again. Except the book tells of a witness who stepped forward to tell a different story. A friend in the same grade, her book name was Sherry, was also homesick with flu that day. She had been talking to Brandy on and off over the phone line all morning, and she was the last person to talk to Brandy before her death. Brandy mentioned that she would have to hang up because her mom is dropping off lunch, and that she wanted to take a bath and get dressed as well. Then there was a knock at the door. Brandy went to answer, then suddenly the call died. Sherry tried to call back, but there was never any answer. She said she lived with it ever since, thinking it was the killer who interrupted their call, because why would mom knock? In the end, both the official story and the book's story are thin. The passerby are released by authorities less than 24 hours after the murder, and the author never had the opportunity to interview him. A firefighter swears the passerby was never there, while a newspaper strangely never printed his name. Everything always comes back to the passerby, a man you might have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, or exactly where you meant to be.
That concludes our covering of the book. As we move forward, we will be talking about two other murder cases from the same area that may be connected to Brandy, Tammy Lamell and Darlene Hulse. So, once again, if you have any information relating to these cases, you can reach us at underestimatedtips@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Underestimated Brandy Peltz was researched, written, and produced by Gracie, Lexi, and Jacob. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Jacob. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community School's Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.